Welcome to season 3 of And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. I've written with hundreds of artists and writers over the years, and my favorite part of each session is the first hour when we catch up about life, the industry, politics, composition, whatever. So this is a journey of learning why people write songs, how people write songs, and most importantly, who the people are who write the songs. I'm producing this with the great Joe London, Big Deal Music Publishing, and Mega House Music Management. If you want to listen to the songs we discuss in this podcast, follow us on our socials, find out about special events, or buy some of our merchandise, go to our website, www.andthewriteris.com. Oh, and if you enjoy this podcast, please rate us on whatever your preferred podcast listening site is. We really appreciate that effort. Today's podcast is brought to you by Bandzoogle. From weekend warriors to Grammy winners, Bandzoogle powers the website for tens of thousands of musicians around the world. So whether you're just starting out or looking for an affordable solution to build a new website and manage your direct-to-fan sales, you can use Bandzoogle's simple tools to design a website and store that both you and your fans will love. Go to Bandzoogle.com to try it free for 30 days. And be sure to use the promo code ATWI. That's ATWI to get 15% off the first year of your subscription.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to And the Writer Is. I am your host, Ross Golan. Today's writer, artist, actor is a Golden Globe nominated iHeartRadio Music Video Awards International Artist of the Year winning, multi-platinum number one singing winner of the Songwriter Hall of Fame's Hal David Starlight Award. While most kids were in second grade, he was on Broadway. While most kids were in high school, he was selling out arenas all over the world. From the great state of Texas, this quadruple threat has acted alongside the biggest names in Hollywood, sung in front of tens of thousands of fans, written hits with the biggest names in the music industry, and now runs a record label. But the most impressive part of today's guest is that he's as philanthropic as he is multi-talented. Not a bad start for someone who's only 25 years old. And the writer is someone I first met backstage at the House of Blues on Sunset for an Honor Society concert, Nick Jonas.
That's the single greatest intro I've ever heard.
Well,
thank you for that.
You can just start playing that whenever you walk in the house.
I like it. I will, actually.
Yeah.
It's good to see you.
Good to see you, too. That is actually really interesting. So I was in a band, and then I was writing with Jared Scharf, the guitarist from SNL, and he knew the guys from Honor Society, and we did Here Comes Trouble, and that was
great song.
Thank you. And that was the first time I'd really written outside of being in a band.
Yeah.
And the big thing about it was that, one, their manager is your father.
Yes.
And they were opening for you. So we would get to go, we went to, you know, Staples Center and seeing all this. And this was just mind-blowing because I just didn't even know this world existed. And so to see, like, you know, what it is to write a song in a small space and then see it on a much bigger space is like...
It's electrifying. It's a crazy feeling.
Electrifying.
But how long was it after the House of Blues that they were in Staples, for instance, with us? It was about a year, right?
Yeah, that might be right.
Yeah, that's just the timeline of that all is so crazy. And then I love that aspect of like the songwriting process as a whole. As you know, you write so many songs and some of those make it out of that small room and actually see the light of day, and then some don't. But then some actually transcend into a room where other people are singing along. And I think it's the best payoff you can have as a creator, or one of the best, I should say. And It's nice that that's how we met.
It is.
Set the foundation for a great friendship, both creatively and, you know, emotionally.
Yeah, specifically emotionally. I mean, we cuddle like nobody.
Dude, we cuddle.
We're cuddling
so
right
hard.
Now. People just can't see it. Okay, so let's start from the beginning a little bit. So you're on Broadway, but before you go to Broadway, you were born.
I was born.
That was a start. So you're in Dallas.
Yeah. So
how do you end up in New York in 7 years?
So basically, my dad was in ministry. So he and my mom met in the registration line at Christ for the Nations, which is a Bible college in Texas. And then they got married right after they finished college and started traveling, playing music. And then my mom had a sign language team. So she was a sign language teacher and sign language ministry. And they would do this thing all across the country. And they stopped different places for about 2 or 3 years. And then they went to New Jersey and had my oldest brother, Kevin. Then they went to Arizona and lived there for a little while. My brother Joe was born there. And they went back to Texas to teach at the very school that they met at. My dad was the head of the music department at the school. And so music was always kind of around from the very minute I was born. And my earliest memory of music is being in this drum, sort of like, it was a soundproof drum coffin. I don't know what you would call it, but like a cage, basically. Because, you know, the drummers apparently played very loud during the worship songs. I'm not really sure. But I went in there and started banging around on the drums, and that's the first time I remember making music of any kind. And lived there for first three years of my life, then moved to New Jersey. My dad became a pastor at a church there. Again, playing in church for my whole childhood, transitioned into, I was at a hair salon with my mom. I was 7 years old, and someone heard me singing because I would just sing all the time. It's probably really fucking annoying, but I did it. But she was getting her hair done, and I was singing, and this woman next to my mom said, "My son is doing a Broadway show in New York right now. You should take your son to his manager if he is interested in performing." So I went to see the manager, and I walked in, and all I knew was pop songs, you know, like the golden era of late 90s pop music, and like Celine Dion and Shania Twain. And the manager said, "We need some show tunes, so come back in 6 months when you've learned these songs." And it was like, "Sing, sing a song, sing out loud, sing out strong," and a bunch of other ones, and songs from Oliver and other things. And I came back, and she heard me sing and acting out and being really dramatic, 7-year-old. And she sent me on auditions, and I did Broadway shows for, you know, 5 years after that.
It's crazy.
That's a long story. Sorry.
No, that's good. Because this next segment is, what would Kevin Jonas Sr. ask Nick Jonas? And he said to me to ask you about when you guys would drive into New York, you would always say, "Let's write a song on the way."
Mm-hmm. Well, my dad and I are very close, and that's nice that he asked that question. But, you know...
Shout out Kevin Jonas
Sr. You know, I think for both of us at that time in our lives, you know, at this point I was like 7, 8 years old, starting to fall in love with creating music. My dad was also introducing me to a whole nother world. So he always had a real appreciation for pop music, and he wasn't kind of cynical about it. You know, he was really a fan of great pop music creators. And then he just educated me going back in time, starting with, you know, things like Carole King and the Jackson 5 and Stevie Wonder. So transitioning from sort of pop to soul, singer-songwriter, and just giving me the full lay of the land.
And you had time, you were always... If you're working in New York and you're living in New Jersey, you still have an hour plus drive in and out of the city.
So 2 hours combined travel every day just to become a music student and then in turn write songs. And I got to give my appreciation to him for being so patient, because I'm sure that my ideas at 8 or 9 years old were not the best.
Do you have any idea what your first song was?
Actually, I do. And it's a funny story, because I thought I wrote a Savage Garden song. I really was convinced that I wrote this song and was so angry. There's two memories I have from my childhood that are so out of character for me, but I think really character building in a sense. The first is, I was in preschool And I walked in, and this kid was wearing an Oakland Raiders t-shirt, the black shirt with the, you know, sort of silver and white. And I had the same t-shirt. And I didn't know at this time that you could, there was more than one t-shirt. So I walked in and I pushed him. So you stole my t-shirt. That's my one of my first like confrontation memories. I got disciplined and it was all fine. The other thing was
Do you know his name?
I don't. I can't remember. I remember he had blonde hair though and sort of like a bowl cut.
Because out there, he's probably doing a podcast. Like, this is so crazy. But yeah. I went to preschool. I was totally innocent. I was wearing this shirt. The guy pushed me. He said I stole his shirt. I wasn't.
It's a good lesson to learn, though. Yeah, exactly. There's more than one shirt.
This is a weird day for everybody.
Me and my brothers all wear the same size. I had to learn that one quick when he's stealing my shit again. So the other one was basically I'm listening to the radio with my dad, and the Savage Garden song comes on. I knew I loved you. That's them, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And I was convinced. It's like, they stole my song. He's like, Nick, I was like, no, I wrote this song. And I was furious. And also, maybe I did, right? Maybe I wrote a chorus that was similar. As we all know in the songwriting world, it's very possible to come up with a similar melody over similar chords. So I'm convinced to this day that I deserve 15% of the song.
Right. It's a plausible scenario that we could get a hold of Savage Garden's
There's
management.
There's no way for them to say, I didn't write it.
Just so you could call them and just be like, this is so weird. But I'm pretty sure I wrote this when I was six.
I love this. Someone said this to me one time, for real. Real songwritery thing. There's no way for me to prove that I wrote it. But there's also no way for you to prove that I didn't.
I didn't write it. Yeah.
And I was like, well, you got me there.
Right. You're on Broadway for 5 years. Are people, those worlds, as I've learned recently, are not this, they're just not the same people as the pop world, as a record world. I mean, there are some labels that obviously are based in New York, especially then, you know, where people, you know, maybe on weekends they're going to see shows. So they have, you know, some idea of who these people are. But it's been a long time since a Broadway actor ends up having a music career outside of Broadway. You know, that was the norm for a while, but it's super rare now. What brings you into the room at a major label when, you know, here's a kid who's on Broadway, but how do you get from there to getting the record deal?
Okay, so I was in Beauty and the Beast at the time. It was my third show that I was doing. I did it for a year.
Who were you in Beauty and the Beast?
Played Chip the Teacup.
Ah.
Yep. So they basically, there's this big secret, and I'm still sworn to secrecy, but the way it worked in the show is it was a drink cart, you know, like a tea cart.
Yeah.
But you would see the head of the kid playing Chip, but you would not see the body. Right. So they had, I think it was Copperfield or David Blaine, come and do all the magic in the show. And people were blown away by this trick. But the little hint, again, I'm not allowed to even say it today, is that you're kind of crammed into this small space. And so after about a year, I outgrew the role. But Chip the Teacup was one of my shining moments. And also on dates, like when I've said that, played Chip the Teacup, there's like this, every time, it's like it's like a winning moment.
Yeah, at least, anyway. I mean, it's like the most lovable character.
It's the most lovable character in the world.
Is there a song out of Beauty and the Beast that you don't know?
A song out of Beauty and the Beast that I don't know.
Like, basically, my assumption is that as soon as someone's like, you know, bonjour, you're like, fuck, I got to sing through the next 2 hours
straight.
Dude,
that's the problem of being a theater kid as a whole, is that when you meet another one
and
you know the same shows, you just sing them for hours. And then, like,
yeah.
Because it was a job that I did, even as a kid, for a year, it's kind of ingrained in my memory. But no, there's not one that I don't know from that one. And when there was the extra songs in the movie, like the one that just came out, I was a little put off because I knew it so well. And then I felt like they had thrown me a curveball I wasn't expecting, and I felt personally offended. Not really.
Right, exactly.
But
before we go back to the
story
question
that
I asked, but
do
you think, is the goal to end up back there on Broadway?
On Broadway? Yes. I just finished the first draft of a play that I wrote, and we just did the first reading in New York.
Cool.
I don't know. You know, it's a really tough thing to break ground on a new play. You know, it's sort of, especially on Broadway, it's a really big challenge. I think in a perfect world, I'd see this thing on stage in the next 12 months somewhere, whether it's one of the nonprofits in New York, you know, New York Theater Club, something like that.
Yeah.
Or if we do it out of town and see what happens. But I'm really excited about the idea of just creating, both, you know, as a musician, but also as an actor, and then now as a writer in this other space. It's been really fun. So yes, I hope to go back, and maybe this will be the vehicle or something else.
Cool.
But to answer your question before, I was doing Beauty and the Beast. Every year during Christmas time, they put together this CD, but they put together this record called Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS. And it's covers of Christmas songs as a relief effort. And I said to my dad, I said, what if, you know, we write a song for it? He said, I don't think they're going to allow an original song. So let's just try. So we sat down on a Monday, which is the day off that Broadway goes dark, and we wrote this song called Joy to the World, A Christmas Prayer. And then we brought it to the people, the producers of Beauty and the Beast, and they went and pitched it to Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS. I said, we'd love to have this original song on the recording. So first time in a studio, went in, recorded the song, some of my castmates singing the choir parts. And
wow.
It's a really nice song.
How old were you at the time?
I was 9.
Yeah.
And then basically this guy started coming to the church and asking my dad a lot of questions. Part of ministry goes beyond basically the time that you're there preaching or performing weddings, you know, like, or funerals, whatever. It's ministering to people on a very human, personal level. So he would build these great friendships and relationships with people. And one of the guys that he built this relationship with said he worked at Sony Music Group, which could have meant he was the head of the label, or that he, you know, was a janitor. Like, we don't really know. We didn't know until he said, you know, I heard the song that your son did, and I would love to play it for one of the A&R guys at the company. My dad tried to have a career in music and country music as a younger man, and has some great stories from that time. So he was very familiar with the lingo and like the world and how it all worked. And so he was like, sure, but you know, who knows? So that guy turned out to be Bob Bolin, who at the time was head of business affairs for international, for every Sony Music Group label, Epic, Columbia, at the peak of that era, you know, 2000 to 2004. He played it for David Massey, of all people, at Daylight Records, the imprint on Columbia Records. And David Massey is, to this day, one of my closest friends, kind of, in some ways, a bit of a mentor and a guiding light for me. And our story, like, we, you know, we were not always working together, but the fact that now I'm back at his label, you know, Island, and we have our imprint together is kind of a crazy,
awesome,
small world, like, full circle thing. So that's how I got signed.
So at 9 years old, Dave Massey is your A&R guy?
So, yeah, basically it took
so
about a year.
He's been your A&R guy for, you know, all said and done,
years.
He's going to end up being, yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, so I remember the meeting so well. I went to the big building, 550 Madison Avenue. It's just so funny. Like, even now, you know, this is, well, 15 years ago, basically, but so much has changed. And for anyone that's, like, just entering the music business now or kind of, like, in the last 7 years has broken through, like, you really would not have even seen this era. I saw, like, the very last couple years of it, you know, Donny Einar and the thing, you know, and it was a crazy time. So I go up this building, it's the top floor, and he's got this office in the corner office, and it's me, my dad, Bob Bolin, David Massey, and David just says, can you sing something? I've heard the song, it's great, but I want to see if you can sing for me now, and, you know, basically testing if I could sing live. And so I started singing Signed, Sealed, Delivered, Stevie Wonder, and then he was like, wow, this is great. You want to see something cool? And he brought me to this hallway where they just had, like, these giant drawers filled with CDs.
Oh, my God. Those were the best.
The best. And you could just walk in and just grab whatever you wanted. So I left with, like, Oasis CD, like, the, you know, all the shit. And it was such a crazy time.
These goodie bags of
goodie bags.
CDs. If that's all you got out of meetings from CDs, like, or meetings with label people, it's just, like, it was always worth it.
Yes, it was.
So then you get a deal, and then they're like, let's make an album.
Yeah, so it was a joint venture between Daylight Columbia and INO Records, which was the home of Mercy Me, the Christian music group that I'm a big fan of. But Jeff Mosley was the guy that had a label there, and they had a joint venture to do a Christian crossover pop record for an 11-year-old. So it's just like a big old challenge. But we recorded the song called Dear God, which actually was released to Adult Contemporary and Christian radio and kind of had like a little bit of a moment. But I think, you know, trying to make a full album on an 11-year-old kid is really tough because, you know, it's sort of like, what is it? What's the mark? And he's not quite old enough to be a teen heartthrob. He's not quite young enough to get away with like singing things that are, or he's too young to get away with singing things that are too mature. So it was just a big challenge.
And your literal voice is changing on a monthly basis at that age. It's really complicated to do that.
Really tough.
But when you write with young people too, it's like you have to remember, it's like these people have no past.
Yeah.
So you can't write about the love you had. You can't talk about anything you had because you had nothing.
See, my issue though was, you know, that's what really pissed me off is like we had the song called Crazy Kind of Crush, which was basically, it was kind of like the new school answer to like a Jackson 5 thing. Because I got this awesome, amazing, crazy kind of crush on you. I'm 10, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, so annoyed. I'd be in the car with my dad, so infuriated. Like, it's not fair. I could sing about more than this. I just come from Broadway where like Les Mis is like, you know, look down, like really sad and emotional. And they're saying that I need to sing about like having a crush.
Yeah,
like, this is beneath me.
Yeah.
So
should we go
through
some Les Mis songs, right? Real quick.
We should, dude. I don't know if we have to license them though if we do that. But I had writing sessions for like a year and a half. Did an album photo shoot, all this stuff. Got together a pretty good group of songs and some really heavy ones. Like, you know, in my effort to like be mature at this young age, wrote songs like this one that was called Appreciate. Opening line of the song: there's a man dying on the side of the road, won't make it home tonight. It's about like this guy, right? He's like, won't make it home, but he calls his daughter right before he goes and says, take the time to appreciate. Like, heavy. For some reason, that's where my head was at 11 years old. But we write these songs, and then one day my fucking brothers come in and they go, have you heard this Switchfoot album? I was like, no. Like, there's a song called 24. Everyone sit down. Just like that. It was like the scene from a Will Ferrell movie. Where like, here I am, working my ass off, trying to make this album. My brothers come in and say, you ever heard this Switchfoot album? And they sit the whole family down and play us a song called 24, which to this day, like, just hits me so emotional in a really emotional way because it was the moment that they stood up and were like, we're also musicians, which I was just not really aware of. I know they liked music. Joe had done a Broadway show as well, but claimed that he wanted to be more of an actor. And they started playing, and it was like, oh, my God.
Well, so they literally played it. They weren't, like, playing the CD.
No,
they,
my brother Kevin sat there played with the guitar, which he played in the church band. But like he like applied himself and like played it and Joe sang. And I was like, oh my God, this is happening. This is going to happen. And again, I'm a kid, right? So like the balance is like, it if I was in my dad's position as an adult, I don't know if I could have handled it as good as he did. It was really incredible because it was such a tough moment. Basically, I wrote a song with my brothers the next day. I was like, you guys are great. Like, let's write a song. We write this song called Please Be Mine. My dad calls David Massey and says, the boys wrote a song together that you should hear. We go into the office the next day, play it for David and David Gray, who's my publisher still to this day. And they both can sit there. And David described it to me as saying basically to himself in his head, like, I got it. Like, it was like an aha moment, you know. And then they wanted to sign all three of us. So my dad takes me to lunch as like a 11, 12-year-old kid to tell me that like this thing that was so exciting for me, this like amazing opportunity was now going to be all of us. And like just me wrapping my head around that, I was like really disappointed for whatever reason. I think I just felt like, oh, my dream was no longer mine and I've got to include others. And then I like came to in the conversation because he said like, you'll get to do this with the people that love you most, and you'll get to travel the world with people that love you and care about you, and you guys are great together. And it was like, oh yeah, of course I want that, you know? And then we made a record together, and it didn't do well. And then we got dropped by our label. but not David Massey. We got sort of taken by another executive, made his project, he championed it, and it was not authentic to who we were. It was sort of like a punk rock boy band.
Were you still writing all the songs?
Writing a lot of the songs. We wrote about 50% of the album, but he had some that from, you know, some outside writers that specialized in the pop punk thing. It's the great lesson to learn at that age of like, do what you do. And right. No matter what, like stick to what you feel is authentic to you. And I mean, I'm like straight. This is also the challenging thing was that I was just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. The church that my dad was pastoring, the whole thing fell apart and was really hurtful to the whole family and became years of like healing from that experience in the church. The place that was supposed to be safest, the sanctuary, became really hard for all of us. And so all these things kind of happened. We got dropped by our label. We are staying in a small two-bedroom home with the four boys, my parents, and our uncle who was living with us, paying like $700 in rent a month as like a favor from someone that went to the church that was loyal to the family. It sounded like Game of Thrones, loyal to the family. But who was, you know. And we had, so my parents dug into their pockets, and for my birthday, they got me a V-drum kit, drum kit. And they put it in the basement of this house. And the thing that was cool is you could plug the aux cord in and play along to your favorite music and learn how to play the drums well. So I play the drums every day for 4 hours, and I would grab a guitar and play for 2 or 3 hours. And I go sit at our piano, which is the one in this house here, and write songs on the piano. And I wrote 4 of the songs on that piano and another 4 with the brothers on the guitar in that house that would become the record that broke us open on Hollywood Records that sold like 8 million around the world.
Yeah, it's incredible. Okay, here's the deal. I am technologically challenged. I've always been technologically challenged. I barely know how to use this computer to record this thing that I'm recording right now. So I can guarantee you that I cannot build a website. And when I was in a band, I just needed something to help me build my band's website. Well, you are in luck because today's podcast is brought to you by Bandzoogle. Bandzoogle makes it easy to build a stunning website for your music in minutes. Choose from over 100 mobile-friendly themes. Then customize your design and content in a few clicks with Bandzoogle's easy visual editor. All the features you need for a professional website are already built in, including tools to sell your music and merch commission-free right on your website, mailing list tools to grow your fan list and send newsletters, integrations to pull in content from all your online services like Twitter, Instagram, and SoundCloud, and live support from their musician-friendly team 7 days a week. Bandzoogle plans start at just $8.29 a month and include your own free custom domain name. Go to bandzoogle.com to try it for free for 30 days. And be sure to use the promo code ATWI. That's ATWI to get 15% off the first year of your subscription. Bandzoogle, websites built for musicians by musicians. Did you learn things like math? Or like science growing up? Or is this like...
No, I didn't even went to
like,
school.
It sounds like you lived in like the greatest childhood of all time. You're like...
Yeah, I went to school...
Even though obviously there were those struggles, it sounds like where it's like, okay, instead of doing anything that all the other kids do, we're just going to let, you know, just go and figure music. This out.
Yeah. Well, actually, I failed music in school though. I got an
really?
F in music in school. My teacher was just like annoyed with
me. We got to get that report card and
I know,
it should be framed. Yeah.
No, I really did. In second grade, I had a music class and I stood up in defiance and said, this doesn't make any sense. Swear to God, this is a true story. I stood up and said, this makes no sense. She was like, what doesn't, Nicholas? And I was like, music is not math. Music is not math. She's like, I don't know what you mean. And in my head, I always saw music as like a series of good decisions. I was like shopping for something, like pulling stuff off the shelves and being like, this will mix well together. And then we go and make it and we see what we have afterwards. And you don't lose if it's not great, right? Like, it's just a good swing. But I was so frustrated that there was like math to music.
It's like, do you feel that way now? That
yeah.
There's still no math?
Because I still don't know how to do math.
Yeah.
First of all, I'm terrible at anything besides
But when
simple.
You write from a place of still picking off the shelves. You don't write from a place of like, oh, this mathematically is the right place to go.
Well, I think it's a balance now. I mean, I think because... here's what I think I've learned. The biggest lesson is that the worst thing that can happen in your life and career is to have a hit. Because you then base everything you're doing off of that. And probably not what made it great, but what made it successful, which I think is really dangerous. And as an artist, you tend to drop into, how do I take the business approach and not feel guilty about it when crafting this song? What will my fans like? What will work at radio? All these different things. When the times where it has really worked for me, at least, and a lot of people I've talked to, is when they go, fuck it. I'm going to do what I want to do and what feels natural to me. And if the pre-chorus is 3 bars instead of 4, like maybe it's supposed to be, and that just feels right. I'm going to go with that.
But you've always been good about, you know, obviously you have the capability of taking songs from nothing to a song. You know, like you are in a basement writing on piano and on a V drum kit, and you write a song from nothing, and those things sell, you know, however many millions in the U.S., however many millions worldwide. So you know you can do that. And then, but you've always been one of the artists that everyone enjoys writing with because you're willing to take starts from other places. You're willing to like work with. I mean, the whole point of the co-writing thing is that you can still be yourself and try not to think of the business part as much.
Yeah.
And then let the people around you who... that's their job in a way, is to try to pull you into that world a little bit and let you still be yourself.
I had a really interesting year, like in 2010, I the brothers and I had just sort of taken this hiatus. I made this side project record that was like a blue-eyed soul thing called Nick Jones, The Administration.
Yeah, with John Fields.
John Fields.
Hell yeah.
It was a really fun record to make, but Joe was doing a solo project. And so I was a bit delusional in the sense that we were really lucky because, you know, we were working with Disney, but when it came to our music, they really let us take the creative control along with John Fields, who was our producer. And he and I would spend all of our time together crafting what those records were, and it wasn't like a formula on Disney's part. It was just literally the songs we were writing and we would make them. So I thought it was just going to be that way everywhere else. So my publisher and management team was like, you should like write for other people. Like Ryan Tedder does it, and he does it really well. And he's obviously brilliant, but I was like still learning. And so I booked out Henson, the A room, and like set up a full like writing situation.
That's the room, by the way, for listeners, where they did We Are the World.
Yeah, it's
so
huge.
It's not like this small, like, oh, this small studio. It's like the studio.
It's the studio. And you don't lock that studio out for like 30 days. Like,
right.
That's just not a smart economic decision.
Right.
So, especially when there's no one paying you to be writing these songs, right? So it's just like, yeah, I'll just like book this out and like write a bunch of the hit songs.
Yeah.
That's what I thought was going to happen. And I didn't get one cut, but I had different co-writes every single day. And that was where I learned how to co-write with people that were not my brothers, or people in the band, you know?
Yeah.
First day was Brian Kennedy.
Wow.
And Dwayne Whitmore, who is Dwayne's one of my still favorite people to collaborate with, and we've written a bunch of songs for my records, and he's a great friend of mine. And then the next day was like Lady V, and it was like every single day was somebody new. And then I got to work with Glenn Ballard, which was amazing. In that 30 days, we wrote this beautiful song called Daylight, still one of my dad's favorite songs I've ever written. But they never saw the light of day. And so I left thinking like, okay, cool. I just like banged out 30 days of writing songs and I'm going to like see this turn around in 9 months and be on the radio. And it just didn't happen. And I think...
Why didn't you release them yourself? Did any of them make sense for yourself?
No, not really. But I think the other thing was like, I don't think they were good enough, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm not sure if...
when it comes down to it, like maybe the songs weren't...
They weren't great.
Yeah.
But it was awesome to learn how to co-write and to be in a spot where I was just able to start being creative with like a forward-thinking mind outside of just my little bubble.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Going back to your little bubble, I remember saying to right around the Honor Society days and stuff, this is when I learned about the Jonas Brothers, because at that time, like, there aren't a lot of guys in their late 20s that are listening to Jonas Brothers.
Yeah.
And so I didn't really have any, like, I had no gauge on what this was until seeing what your audience would show up for the opening act, because they showed up with their parents and they were engaged from the first song of the opening act. And my experience was always being an opening act was that no one wanted to see you and they couldn't wait for you to leave. Your fans were like, loved whoever opened for you with like the same passion that they could love, everything that they could love. It was all about like this crazy thing. And I remember saying to my bandmate, who sucks, but as a human, but he, I remember saying to him, I was like, you have to understand that these kids are the future. Like, you were writing songs that a whole arena could sing every word to at 14. I was like, this is some LeBron shit. You don't understand. Nobody else was doing that. I remember using that example because it was, you know, it was like he was the prodigy who never, you know, the last of the guys who didn't have to go to college and just were able to play pro. And you were playing these pro arenas and all the instruments and doing all this writing as a primary writer, even some with your brothers, some on your own. But you were doing it so young and so professionally. It was, like, you had no idea. There's no way you had like a real gauge on how unusual that is, right? Or
yeah, I mean, I feel very, to this day, I feel very lucky. Just
looking back at that, you have to be like, that's another human, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I wish, here's what I look back and think, like, I wish some of those instincts that were within me then were still as real now, in the sense that I've almost learned too much, where I have to work backwards. Like, at 14, 15, you're just writing instinct. It's like, my heart's broken. I'm going to write the heartbreak song, but I'm going to write the best fucking version of that I can. And then, you know, that's what you have. But it's sort of more raw than crafting the internal rhyme or like the great concept. Like, how do we like songwriter this out a little bit? Right. Whereas at 14, I mean, literally like just raw emotion or excitement about something. It's like, there's no filter of you can't yet. You can't do that.
Did you have your heart broken?
Yeah.
By who?
By Miley. Yeah. I mean, it was like high school, dude. Like, all of us were, it was just, it's the whole thing. Like, that graduating class of Miley, Selena, Demi, myself, Joe, Kevin. Like, it was that group.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Do you guys all keep in touch now? I mean, obviously, Demi.
Demi, yeah, we keep in touch. Miley and Selena, not so much. I mean, we see each other and it's fine, but we don't stay as in touch as we used to. Certainly.
What is it about those generations of, you know, the Disney artists that, like, what is it that you learn in that process that makes everyone so successful? Or is it that they find people really young that are really talented?
I think It's tough to say exactly what it is. I think that they've got a really good eye for who will work for their platform.
Yeah.
And then the reality is, say what you want about Disney, and a lot of people, I think, after they're done working with Disney, feel that they want to speak poorly about the process. And I've gone through my own, you know, waves in processing what that was like. I think that there is an immense amount of pressure put on children at a young age, and that's not healthy. But I don't think that that's one corporation's fault. I think that that's like the world's fault in a sense.
We've been watching a little bit of, sorry to interrupt, but we were with Mio, who is the head of A&R for Hollywood right now. And one of the best things that he says is like, he was just really concerned in making sure that his artist that we had in the room was really well taken care of, and that they've gotten really protective of making sure that their younger artists have, you know, parenting when their parents aren't there.
Well, I think that,
do you know what I mean?
You know, you as a kid performing, it's your dream. You never really, when you get to that level, you're not pushed to do it, because it you almost have to be driven from within to want to work that hard. Like, it has to be you. It's not a parent, I don't think, personally. And all my friends that were in it were not pushed by others. They were really driven. But I think what makes it challenging is the expectation that because you work so hard, you do so much, that you have to be an adult when you're still learning really valuable life lessons at such a young age. And so that pressure was there, but thankfully, you know, I had my parents and Phil McIntyre, my manager, from day one, as really, you know, sort of the real foundation and understanding that it's okay to like not be okay when you're that young, and to learn and to work through it, you know.
When you did the Administration album, I remember that going around and being like, this is such an adult record. And I mean that, and like, not that the stuff before wasn't adult, but even the players around you were adults. So there was like a different kind of, like, I don't want to say like sophistication, but it felt like it was coming from a different place. Were you saving those songs? Did you want that to sound the way it did? And how did you feel about like the response to that album, having just come off of, you know, this crazy sort of Jonas Brothers run?
I loved making the record. I feel like part of it was just needing the process of, like, you know, setting up ISO booths and the whole band recording at the same time, little to no overdubs, songs that were like unapologetically bluesy and kind of left to center. I think that the reception to it was good. I mean, I don't know, I kind of have lived and balanced disappointment and respect from my peers like my entire career, and it's still something that
are those the opposites? Like, what do you mean by that?
I mean, like, I think I have an unrealistic expectation at times, or did then especially, of people's view of my work, or like their or that even like accolades matter, you know. I think that one of the things that was tough, in the way I was talking about song, like hit songs being almost a bad thing in some ways, like, we were nominated as the brothers for Best New Artist in the year that Adele won. And that kind of messed with my head a little bit, because I started to play towards critical acclaim and like thinking that was important. I think it's sort of naive to think that we would have actually won that at all, ever, you know.
Why?
Because Adele... Because Adele.
Yeah, right.
No, but also just, I feel like we had a lot of growing to do.
Yeah.
And even now, so, you know, I think that I've had to always balance my view of my own work and my hope for its level of critical acclaim. Like, just manage those expectations and stay focused on the work and not necessarily, like, the result afterwards, you know.
Sure.
Because you're only going to be disappointed, I think.
The time from the Administration to Jealous, it's kind of like a long span for you.
Yeah.
You know, because everything else was like this year, there's always something coming out. And then you kind of like have like a moment of kind of regrouping, it seems like.
Yeah.
You know, how soon after administration did you start thinking like, okay, let's redefine who I am, and going in for, you know, doing that session with Nolan and Simon, you know, doing like, what was the process to go into this next phase?
Process was that I went back and did Les Mis over in the West End. And
who were you in this time?
Marius. So I did that and I learned how to sing again. So
you're no longer Chip.
Yeah.
And
exactly. It was a more mature thing as a whole, but I learned how to sing and sustain my adult voice, which was a really good lesson to learn, because on the Administration album, especially, you can hear it. I was singing through my voice change so much that I think I did like some just like too much growling and like work mechanisms to sing higher notes that were a bit unhealthy for the voice. So I did that and like, again, just like relearned how to sing, and it was great. And then I had my first like real adult relationship that was really important as well, and incredibly creative relationship, and it was with another artist, and it was very inspiring to like sit and talk music and not feel like embarrassed or like it was like I don't know, it was just really sort of...
Were you in London during all this?
No, I was back here after that, and then I went on with this person on a songwriting retreat to Bali, and had like one of the best experiences ever there. And so songwriting and like just creating started to become a passion again. And then my brothers and I started working together again. We went on like a couple tours. You could really feel it was like the last hoorah, and like this shit was falling apart. I mean, it was just not
emotionally,
not healthy.
Or what do you mean?
Everything. Yeah. Creatively, emotionally, we were trying to write new music, but we were clashing because I was like kind of steamrolling a bit and was pretty adamant about producing it all as well.
Did you know that at the time?
No. Looking back, I can see that it was that.
Right.
But, you know, it just also was just no longer authentic for us to be making music together. It just didn't make sense anymore. And we all kind of wanted different things. And that blew up in our faces. But I had started, like, recording some stuff that I was sort of pushing to the side. The song called Santa Barbara, which was on my first solo record. And another one. And I just was like, something's brewing. And at this point, this was years later. It was the sort of timelines all messed up. But I just was also getting really into acting again, doing some stuff in that world. And the band split up and I led that conversation. It was really, really tough couple days of working through what that was going to be like. We had spent a lot of our own money because we were no longer with Hollywood and trying, and just nothing was working that we were doing. Put out a single, it didn't work. Like, it's a really tough moment for us as brothers and also as a band, obviously. So we finished that. And I'm in New York. At this point, hadn't seen David Massey in a couple of years. We'd like had lunch once, but that was about it. From the time we left Hollywood, which was almost 8 years earlier, or not Hollywood, Columbia. And he wrote me an email and said, "Are you okay? I'm seeing the news. Would you like to meet for lunch?" And I sat down with him at lunch and talking about, you know, like music. And I was sort of just so like jaded at this point. I was like so sad and just like disappointed with everything not working and feeling like, you know, creatively I wanted to do something weird and like not care if it was successful or not as a mechanism to set myself up for failure, you know, and be okay with it. And he was like, because I said, you know, maybe I'll just do like a producer name, like a different name, and just fucking put it out, you know. He's like, but don't you want to like travel the world and write like hit songs and be like a big star? I was like, yeah. yeah, I do. And he's like, okay. He's like, well, let's do this. I was like, okay. And I played him Santa Barbara and Push.
Yeah.
Which was a song I wrote, Chase, over there. And he was like, I'm all in. I'm ready to do this with you. I think we have an idea of the direction. He's like, just get in there and like just start writing. Just like write. And I like... second co-write that I did for the thing was with Simon and Nolan. And we like started this one idea. I always love when this happens. You start the one idea, you get like the verse and chorus, and I'm kind of ADD. And I'm like, let's just like go like walk around for a minute and like see. I don't know. It's a good idea, but it could be better. So we like go outside and they ask me about like what happened last night. It's like, ah, oh, man, at this bar, right? And this guy, I think it's like blatantly like hitting on my girlfriend. And it was like really annoying. And they're like, yeah, that's, and I was like, you know, and I just talking about it. And I sort of worked through it in the conversation. I was like, it's totally fine. I'm not like concerned she's going to leave me. And then the songs just kind of wrote itself. We're like sitting there and it's like, Jealous was born out of this conversation. We went back in and finished it like in 10 minutes and basically just get it out. And I remember thinking when it was done, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
But I wasn't like,
number one
smash.
Like, right.
I was like, yeah, it's good. It's cool. And I walked into my manager Phil's office and was like, check this out. We just did this. And he like stood up and he's like, you did it. I was like, did what?
Right.
Like, you wrote a hit. I was like, I don't know. I wasn't convinced till it was on the radio. And I was like, okay, maybe. But yeah, I didn't know.
But this is one of those things where what makes it cool, you know, coming out of everything you had been through is that the lyrics in it are of kind of like somebody who doesn't care about writing hit songs. It doesn't sound manufactured. The lyrics in the middle of that chorus, it just to start the chorus, are kind of bizarre.
They're weird.
Like, they're really cool, and they're super visual, which is really exciting. But you didn't start off saying,
still
like...
still to this day, people are like, what are you saying?
Turn my chin music up.
Yeah. Which is like in baseball, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, but no one really got that. Yeah, but I wasn't trying to write a hit, is the moral of the story.
Right.
Because I feel like you fail when you do that. But then the other great lesson in this time was in the same week that I wrote Jealous, I recorded my first outside song.
Yeah.
And I'd never done that before. And it was so, I was so uncomfortable. I was like, I felt a bit like embarrassed almost. Like, I can't do this myself. Like, people don't have faith in me. Like, I felt like it was my fault or something that I had to like record an outside song. And
but that song did pretty well too.
That song did okay, yeah. But also like Jason Evigan and I become very close friends over the last couple of years. And like this friendship was born out of me being open enough to say like, okay, I can define a template of what works for me, but I also need to trust in these incredible creators around me. Like there's so many brilliant minds and you never know where that next hit's going to come from. So like be open to anything. And then I was like, how many hits did I miss? Because I didn't record songs,
sure.
Right? Like, fuck. So yeah, I recorded Chains that week. And like recorded it in my own studio because I was kind of like embarrassed and then sent it back to him. And he was like, he was pumped. And then we met and like talked about it. Now it's so funny because like someone sends me a song. I'm like, please send all of the songs.
I was upstairs when they were writing Chains downstairs.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And we were upstairs. We wrote this song that ended up being a single for somebody on RCA. And it wasn't great. And I... I remember walking downstairs and there's those moments where you're in a room and you're like, so it wasn't a writing camp really, but you know, it was Amar and Evigan and Danny Parker were downstairs and I forget who I was with upstairs, but you come downstairs and you're like, this room's cool, whatever. It's all fine. And I don't know. There's a little competition that happens in that environment. You know, you want to write the best song of the day or like whatever it is. And you know, when you're in those environments where there are all these really good writers, there are just days where you walk downstairs like, fuck. Yeah. I'm literally, I'm less than, you know, 20 feet away from a hit. It's being written. And just because of the luck of the draw, I'm sure I would have ruined the song. But like, you know, just that thing of like you walking in, damn it, this song's so much better. Yeah. What we're working on. You just have a kind of like have like an ego and you walk downstairs. Yeah, play me what you're working on.
No, that's really good. I have felt that numerous times. And also, it's the uncomfortable thing in like a camp setting when like you feel like you got the vibe. Right? Yeah. You're like, I fucking got it. And then someone comes in and goes, woo, just got the single. And you're like, sick. Because then your great song is like not great anymore. Yeah, it's not the single.
You know what's really cool? And I've said this because we've now interviewed a lot of your co-writers. But one thing that's really true about both Jealous and Chains is that the industry uses those still as markers for artists.
That's cool.
Like behind your back, people like are constantly saying like, we need something that's like the chains sort of drop-ish thing,
unique.
Became a thing that everyone tried to emulate.
Yeah.
For 2 years, it felt like. And Jealous as like a first single, like, oh, we need that kind of song that like doesn't, it's that it's something that you can't control at being the artist and the writer and the yeah. human around it. But people want these songs. So you are at the epicenter of something. I think cool. Levels is really interesting for as a fan, because it didn't do as well as something like Close or Chains.
Yeah.
But I love that song.
It's probably one of my most important live songs.
Why didn't that work?
I don't understand. I think this is something you can attribute to the moment that streaming became really important. Like that time, which I guess was 2015, mm-hmm. It's like all of a sudden streaming was the thing, right? And it was like just that balance. It was just a crazy moment. And so I think it was close to top 10 at radio, maybe. I don't know. But it never like fully broke open. And it never really fully broke open at streaming until now. Like it's picking up on streaming years later.
Yeah.
In the same way that Close has outstreamed all the other songs. And it's like
that was a top 10.
Yeah.
That was radio record.
That was exciting to watch that one go. Cause also another great example of like I walked into a camp room where like they're like, you know, I'll like jump around to different rooms. And I was in with Sean and Matt Men and Robin in the other room, but I was Sean and the Wolf Cousins guys and stuff. Yeah. And I walk into the room, it's Julia and Justin and Matt Men and Robin, and they've got the chorus written and like some scatting on the verse. Mm-hmm. And it's Julia singing it, so it obviously sounds amazing.
Yeah.
And I was like, I would feel rude to like jump in now. Because you guys are like locked into something and it's like, just go. Like, this is great. I love it. I'll record it whenever it's done, if you'll let me, but like, just go. And so they wrote Close, which is like another great, you know, record and a time when it's important to just be like, as creative as I can be, I also want to be able to be like, there's amazing people around me. That's why they're here, you know?
But this is, that personality is why, and I hope other artists are listening to this, because that's why the writing community embraces you and wants to work with you, is that they know that their ideas will be heard one way or the other and that it's about the collaboration. And if it means that you add to it, don't add to it, or whatever the situation is,
yeah.
You're not trying to force something that isn't there, and you're also trying to accept things that, like, the opportunity for, you know, an artist to have a hit song to record is super rare. It's that same yeah. thing, the whole like crux of this podcast of there's, you know, millions of singers, thousands of artists, and only 40 songs per genre at a time.
Yeah.
And you know, when those hit songs show up, to be like, well, I'm not going to record that, is really probably not a smart move, because
yeah.
it can help launch how you then create the next 9 songs as a writer, or it can, like, you know, reestablish.
I'd never want to be the, like, the he passed story on that one, right? Like the,
right.
Oh yeah, can you believe that so-and-so passed on that record? Yeah. Like, I'll just always cut a vocal and be like, if it's not right at the end of the day, I'll know once my voice is on it. But I don't want to be like the after photo, or like the before photo, I guess it would be. And the
has
after.
That happened? Where a hit song came across, where you're like, that's not me.
Yes. There was a time when there was a song that became a really big hit that I was sent, and I just said confidently, I don't think this is right for me, the direction that I want to take. Doesn't feel right. And even when it became a hit, I wasn't there going, I should have. I was still sure that I made the right choice, which I'm like, that's the best example.
Yeah, yeah.
But there have been records that I wanted that I didn't get, and they went to other people. And one time in particular where it was like taken from me, and I was not happy about it. But the song was not a hit. So ha ha
all of you.
Look what you get.
Okay, a few more things. You have a Golden Globe nomination. You know, I know that yeah. you guys just just lost on it. But
they lose. We're losers.
You have a nomination. That's pretty cool. That seems like a kind of a bucket list situation.
That was a big moment. I was very, very happy about that. And to get to share that with Justin and Nick was just amazing. Justin Tranter, Nick Monson. And that song was another one, too, where it was like, I'd been working. They gave me the description of what they needed for the movie, Ferdinand, and like the tone emotionally and also the tempo and everything else. And I was like, all right, this is kind of foreign. I did this back in the day when my brothers and I had a TV show. I would write songs for the TV show with other co-writers. My brothers were both busy with other things, as in not wanting to be. We shot all day, right? We shot 12 hours a day, and then I would go to the studio for another 4 or 5 hours to write. And they were like, "We're no, like, just take the lead. I'll do it." So my, you know, it was a lot. And I was also studying for the CHESPE, which is like the California proficiency test. So I was to be done with high school. So it was like a lot of work at this moment at 16. But anyway, they said, we need this kind of song, this kind of emotion. And I tried like 4 times to write the song, and I just could not get it right. I was like, we get like the verse and the chorus, and I was like, guys, let's go to something else. This isn't right. It's not whatever. And I walk in with Justin. I give him the basic pitch of the thing, show him some visuals for the movie. And we just started talking about, you know, what it feels to be accepted, what it feels to be loved. And for both of us, that's home, you know. And so we went on the live room with the acoustic guitar, dad-gad tuning, started writing the song. And then Nick produced up the track. We recorded it all in a day, and they loved it at the studio. So it was great.
It's awesome. How do you balance all the acting stuff happening now? I mean, you have now been in, you know, massive TV shows and movies.
Yeah, it's a crazy moment. I'm not going to lie. I think that...
Do you feel the pull towards acting over music, or is that never going to be the case, being that...
I feel the pull towards just being creative, to be honest, right now. Like, I'm in a moment where I don't have the next acting project lined up, per se, but I've got
a
general
sense. You just finished something, right? Didn't you just finish
something? Yeah, I finished a movie at the end of last year called Chaos Walking, which is a book series they adapted into a film series, I think. And then Jumanji. I think the success of Jumanji was a humongous surprise to me. I mean, I saw the movie and thought it was great. I expected maybe like 300-400 million worldwide, but to see that we just crossed 900 is insane.
It's so crazy.
And people really love the movie. Yeah. So that, I think it's the first time I've been a part of something where there's so much passion and love for it. Like, Kingdom, this TV show I did, was on a smaller scale just because the audience was limited and the exposure of the show was limited, but people really loved it. But it was a smaller group. This feels like a bit more of like a across the board, people really liked something that we made, and that feels really good. But as I mentioned before, I'm writing a lot, so I'm on like scripts and a play and everything else. So I feel kind of like I'm in a really good moment of feeling a bit settled and content with kind of whatever happens. In the past, I've felt like more pressure to find the next acting project and then what's the next single. And right now, I'm kind of comfortable, but not in a bad way, not stagnant, just comfortable.
Good. I'm going to list 5 people, and you're just going to say the first thing that comes off the top of your head.
Okay.
Phil McIntyre.
The best.
That's your manager, by the way.
My manager, Phil McIntyre, is the best in the whole business. American Idol producer as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Good for him. Demi Lovato.
Also the best. No, but Demi Lovato, fearless. I think that's the best word I can think of.
Are you liking having a record label with her?
Yeah. I mean, it's a really great thing to have control, but also collaborate with Island and the team there because we trust them. And it's been great for both of us.
Joe Jonas.
Joe Jonas. He's free. He's just a free spirit. And I envy that in him. I mean, we're best friends and we live together. We're as close as you can get, basically. And I admire and kind of envy his ability to sort of transcend above things and just be so free and carry himself with so much joy and love for everyone around him. And it's a beautiful thing.
You got to, like, as somebody in the industry, to see the success that you guys have had independently of each other is just so rad.
It's pretty cool.
It's like it's so storybook. It's kind of like an offensive storybook. You know, it's like, come on, like you if you sent that in a script, they'd be like, one of them doesn't do it. You know, not like they both end up with number one songs. That's just not how that is supposed to work out. Kevin Jonas
is kind, very kind, and so just thoughtful. I mean, it's just amazing to see what fatherhood does to a person, I think. And he's got two beautiful girls and a loving wife, and he's just a really thoughtful and kind person, and I love him to death, admire him a lot.
And David Massey.
I don't know, kind of a guiding light. That's the best way to describe it, I think. You know, from the time I was 11 years old in his office, asked me to sing Stevie Wonder to now, I'm able to get more real with him on a personal level in a short amount of time than anybody else I know, really. And I think what's beautiful about the head of a label like that is that he cares about the work and all that, but he really cares about his artist's state of mind first, and that they're healthy and happy. And he's willing to see their vision through in a way that I don't think a lot of head of labels would do.
Right. I just want to let you talk a little bit about your foundation and what you've been doing over, because I feel like that's probably the most important thing that you do. No offense to the music and acting and all the success. Like, you actually change humans' lives. And I think it's important that people know how they can help you achieve those goals.
Yeah, so I mentioned briefly before, but I'm a type 1 diabetic. I was diagnosed at 13. And about a year after I learned how to manage the disease, I decided that it was time that I speak up about it and let people know, you know, how they can get involved to help raise awareness, but also money for research. So I kind of raised my hand and said, I'm a diabetic and want to be open about this and help people that are living with this disease and bring some encouragement, some light. And a couple of years ago, I teamed up with a few other co-founders and started Beyond Type 1, which is an amazing organization that kind of enriches people's lives with diabetes and talks about the management of disease in a really personal way that doesn't feel like clinical. You know, it's sort of more human. And then in addition to that, we offer a lot of grants to other organizations, and both in the management side of things, but also in the eye towards a cure. So beyondtype1.com has all the information. You can check that out. Also, the Instagram is great. And it's been fun and really encouraging to be able to be open about it and know that I'm not alone myself.
Is there any information about, when you say, like, looking for a cure, is there any information as far as, like, who's been pushing that, you know, that research, and who's, like, is there hope for that?
I think there's hope. I mean, I still think it's a little ways away. I think that, you know, there's a lot of things that would have to happen, not just the research aspect and you know, the science of it all, but the money. I mean, I think it would be very expensive. And I think that administering a cure also comes with, you know, shutting down what is a huge business as well, as far as the management of a disease right now.
Interesting.
So I'm kind of curious what that would all look like. And I hope that there's really good people in the mix that will prioritize the cure for people living with the disease, because it is not fun.
Yeah.
And it makes life really challenging. And if it's not managed the right way, it's life threatening, you know?
Sure.
So I am hopeful, but I'm also a bit of a realist about it. And I think, you know, that balancing the optimism with the reality is key.
Yeah. What's advice you'd give to a young songwriter?
Advice I'd give is take really big swings. I like this idea that every time you get up to the plate, you just swing hard, you know, and a good batting average is like 300, right? And so if out of those 10 swings, there's two or three that are awesome or like a good next step, that's a good ratio. And I think I'm more towards like the 175 batting average, but I live a really happy life because I'm getting up to the plate and just trying to take big swings every time.
Well, thank you for doing this podcast.
Thank you for having me. This was enjoyable.
You know, I've said it along the way, but the fact that you're such a staple in the songwriting community says more about how you treat songwriters than anything else, because you know, there are a lot of successful artists that we can name that the writing community despises.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know, and they don't want to go.
I think I know who a few of those are.
Yeah, I'm sure. and it's just always enjoyable. Nobody walks away from hanging out with you and it's like, man, that was a shitty day. Do you know what I mean? And
that's encouraging.
Like, and that's all, but that's all you want is to have a good time and to be around somebody who has your success, but it always feels like, you know, it always feels like home. It always feels really relaxing. It's a good day, and everybody walks away fulfilled that was their experience. I mean, we walked in, and you had just gone basically on vacation with Joe here.
Yeah,
you know, on this writing camp with Thomas Rhett and Sean, and you know, like it's just like trip. The greatest writers in the world for a weekend at a ranch, and it's just like you've always been one of the guys, or you know, one of the people in the room, and everyone just enjoys being around you. So thank you for...
It's cool to hear. Thanks.
For being part of it.
You're the man. This was fun.
Cool. Thanks for listening to this episode of And the Writer Is. If you want to hear music from this songwriter I just interviewed, be sure to check out our Spotify playlist or visit our website at andthewriteris.com. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe to us. You can also like us on Facebook and Twitter. And the Writer is produced by Joe London, edited by Miles Bergsma, and published by Big Deal Music. A special thanks to David Silberstein from Mega House Music and Michael White. On next episode, we sit down with Dave Hodges. Until next time, this is Ross Golan.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.